Science and Wisdom Live is a project of Jamyang London Buddhist Center, a non-profit organization. Please consider supporting us with a donation to help us keep our podcasts and videos free and ad-free. To support us now, please visit our website at scienceandwisdomlive.com. This episode is an excerpt of one of our Science and Wisdom dialogues. To listen to the full recording, please follow the link in the podcast description.
So, David, it's a great honor to have a chance to talk to you today. And I'd like, if you can, just to start by telling us about your work as a writer and academic, and especially how that relates to your experience as a Zen Buddhist teacher and practitioner.
Happy to do that. But first, thank you, Scott, for this invitation and opportunity. I've been very lucky, I think, in that I've been able to combine a very serious commitment to Zen practice with an academic career, you know, not as a Buddhologist, but kind of like a philosopher, comparative philosopher, focusing a lot on Buddhism. And frankly, I have found that very helpful because each, of course, has cast light on the other. So, obviously something like Zen practice has helped me get a deeper sense of what Buddhist teachings are pointing at. But it also works the other way around. Having this sort of academic perspective illuminates aspects of the Zen and Buddhist traditions as well. So I'm grateful for that. But I am actually now retired from academia. And if I'm quite honest, I don't miss it very much.
Can you talk a little bit why it's important to bring together your inner practice and connection with nature, how that helps out to bring a positive change in the world?
It's interesting to look at the pattern, remembering that Shakyamuni Buddha, when he left home on his spiritual quest before he became the Buddha, he went out into the natural world, right? He went into the forest and, you know, practiced there in a number of ways, had his enlightenment under a tree there. And not only the Buddha, but there's so many other figures, Milarepa within Buddhism, but also you think of Jesus, 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, Muhammad's cave. There is something really special about going off into the natural world, especially by oneself, I think, that it can enable us to kind of open up and sort of let go of our usual utilitarian way of relating to everything and sort of be able to learn what the trees, you know, what the meadows, what the river has to offer. It's difficult to love something if you don't have a relationship with it, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think it's so important if we're concerned about what's happening to the earth to reconnect with it, which yeah. We do up there.
I mean, we are part of nature, right? Maybe that's the obvious thing to say, but do you think we forget that sometimes? One of the main themes in your work is the encounter between Buddhism and Western society. And I want to ask you a few questions about that in both directions. Like, what do you think are the main lessons that the Western world has to learn from Buddhism and perhaps other related contemplative traditions too?
I think what I would focus on is the emphasis on personal or individual transformation. I mean, if you think of the history of the Western tradition, I mean, I think there's a lot to appreciate in terms of institutional transformation. If you think about something like anti-slavery movements and civil rights movements and unions and more democratic forms of government, etc. And that's really, really important. But there's also this question, is that kind of collective or institutional transformation enough unless we also have kind of personal transformation? Otherwise, I think it tends to be subverted if we're still motivated, if many people are still motivated by the three poisons of greed, you know, ill will, delusion. That's maybe the most important, the single most important thing that Buddhism has to offer, which is the ecosattva path, frankly, not just regards ecology, but let's call it the bodhisattva path or the new bodhisattva path. That what's so wonderful about that path is one has a double or dual practice. You know, we continue to work on our own transformation, But we know that that's in itself insufficient. It's still, at a certain point, that can actually reinforce the root delusion of separation, mm-hmm. that my well-being is separate from yours and other people. So, you know, we also are engaged out in the world. And what I think one of the really important things about that, I think, is the way those two reinforce each other.
We're more aware than ever of the global challenges and collective forms of suffering. Mm-hmm. So what, can you dive deeper into how you practice a spirituality that promotes both an individual well-being and the health of our society and our environment?
It's interesting you ask that question, yeah. because at the root of it, or you could say the presumption of that is the kind of duality or separation between the two, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I'm reminded of something Joanna Macy said, the world has a role to play in our awakening. I think many of us still have a kind of romanticized idea about the path, even the Bodhisattva path, the idea that somehow you might go off to a cave and meditate really hard or something. And then when you're deeply enlightened, then you return to the world and become engaged, you know, returning to the marketplace. I think that when we start Buddhist practice, perhaps inevitably there's a kind of self-preoccupation, because what brings us to it? I mean, there's some suffering, some dissatisfaction in our own lives. Why else would we spend so much time, energy, and money, you know, making sore legs and backs for ourselves? But as we progress, you know, as we get more insight into what's going on, then if things are going well, we eventually begin to realize that at the root of our dissatisfaction is the delusion of separation,
yes.
from other people and from the rest of the world. So a practice where we continue to think only about our, you know, my own serenity, my own emptiness, my own awakening, at a certain point, that's reinforcing the fundamental problem, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm very inspired by something Nisargadatta said. He wasn't a Buddhist, he was a Neo-Vedantin in India. Mm-hmm. But he said, when I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. Mm. Between these two, my life flows. And I think he's nailed it there, in the sense that as we begin to get in touch with who we really are, that we're not separate from others, other people, and other world, then there's a certain reevaluation of the meaning of our lives away from, you know, what's in this for me, to, you know, what can I do to make this a better world for all of us? Mm. And so that's the sense in which I think they really go naturally together. It's not one or the other. And I think it's so important to see that.
One of my teachers once said, you know, you're more likely to find a bodhisattva in a football stadium than in a meditation cave, you know, because there's more beings to benefit. You want to go out and help. Nice. But, you know, there's something that really struck me as I started studying Mahayana Buddhism once, is that, you know, you have the three jewels you take refuge in, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But it, at least I want to ask if it's similar in your tradition, but in ours, there's another jewel, which is all other beings that you take refuge in. And in fact, that's the one you genuinely can't attain enlightenment without other beings to benefit. there's no way for you to strengthen your own qualities of compassion and action, you know, engage Buddhism without others to engage with. But is that part of, you know, your tradition?
We begin our eco-dharma retreats by taking refuge in the four jewels, right?
Nice.
In the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but also in the wider Sangha, the Sangha of the natural world, of all the beings there. And we see that as an essential part of it. We have to remember that Bodhisattvas vow to save all sentient beings, mm-hmm. all living beings. And in this time of incredible ecological catastrophe, that clearly has to come to the foreground. Yeah.
How do they engage with these problems without these strong feelings of hopelessness and so on?
The problem isn't feeling those feelings. Mm-hmm. The problem is what we do with them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think because of the kind of powerlessness that many of us feel, the tendency is to repress them. It's like we just don't know how to cope or how to deal with them on an everyday level.
What happens when you, quote, fail? How do you deal with that? How do you keep going?
I'm not sure I'm going to say this with regard to ecology, you know, mm-hmm. but sometimes failure is better than success, in the sense of failure can sometimes motivate us more to let go, and again, to help us realize that which we can't lose.
Even success and failure, they're labels, they're dualities, and they kind of relate to this. So there's like famous Buddhist stories of just not knowing whether something that has happened is going to have a positive or a negative outcome. That humility you're talking about is really important. There's a very strong duality against like technology, corporations versus mm-hmm. us natural people out in the forest. Can you talk about that duality and how we can deal with it?
I think there's two sides to it. Mm-hmm. Definitely sort of corporate capitalism in the way that it functions now has a very serious problematical side, given the way that what happens is motivated by profit. And mm-hmm. so if profit is the goal, everything else is the means. And, you know, we see how that can lead to all kinds of problems. Large corporations have this ability to work on the kind of scale that's necessary. And I also think that if some sort of leftists have the idea that we're just going to get rid of corporations and everything will be okay, I think that's a real huge mistake. I think given their presence and given what they have to offer, it's much, much more a matter of sort of revisioning what it is that they can do. And mm-hmm. I think those possibilities are generally there. But it's tricky because, mm-hmm. you know, at this point we have to say they're understanding their goal. Profitability is slowing down as much as possible, the shift to renewables in yeah. ways that just keeps kicking more carbon into the atmosphere. So I think it's a two-sided issue there. Yeah.
Money and what's profitable and what's not is set arbitrarily at the highest level. You know, we decide that some things are inexpensive and some are expensive. So I find that more encouraging, that like some modest changes to our, to even the capitalist incentives, rather, you know, I love Noam Chomsky too, but the idea that we need a global political revolution, maybe we may not need that much to solve this problem.
Well, it may not happen that way. Yeah. yeah. But again, I think it's important to appreciate the don't know mine. It's yeah. clear we're really headed into uncharted territory, you know, yeah. not only ecologically, but socially. So many things are happening, you know, with population, with movements of vast population, with this incredible and I would say obscene and still growing gap between rich and poor. There are so many things going on here. And actually, for me, this highlights one of the really important things that Buddhism has to offer, you know, which is the kinds of practices that we do cultivate, don't know mind, cultivate openness, responding mm-hmm. appropriately to the situation, wherever it may be. And maybe that'll be the most important thing of all, given that, yeah. you know, COVID obviously isn't the end of all the huge emergencies that we're going to be facing, and the ability to face them without freaking out, without panicking is going to be a real premium. I think, frankly, this is not only the most dangerous time ever in human history, as Chomsky said, I think it is also the greatest challenge to the Buddhist traditions and also the greatest opportunity. So in that regard, I think we can cultivate a kind of excited spirit about, wow, what are the new possibilities that are going to arise here? And I, for one, am very excited, you know, to be alive at this time, to be a Buddhist practitioner at this time.